Hey y'all, how's it going?
This thing on? Alright, good.
Hey, I'm Scott Horton. It's my show, The Scott Horton Show. It's already Wednesday. Skateboard day. Well, for those of you who are old men and skate and are from North Austin. Alright, I'm Scott Horton. And this is my show. It's libertarian foreign policy mostly, which means I'm against it. And, I'm just trying to show you that, the truth is that the consensus is wrong. And all the stuff they say is so necessary, just ain't so necessary. Interestingly to me, I saw a thread last night on Twitter. There's a young lady named Tamara, who is a young black lady who is a libertarian. And she jokes that she's like Ron Johnson on the sitcom, where they actually have a libertarian character on a sitcom. Isn't he great, the guy on Parks and Recreation? I don't watch much TV, but I like that guy and that show. Anyway. So she's funny. And anyway, so she says last night on the Twitter, hey, I wonder how you guys, what's the political journey of, ideologies you've been on kind of thing. So everybody's saying, well, I started out as a neocon and then I became a commie and then I was this and then I was that and these kinds of answers. Jesse Walker, I think, had the funniest one, from paleoconservative to Stalinist to something I don't even understand. Anyway, it was great. But there were so many people who answered her. That's what I should do. I should ask questions of the people I tweet to instead of just yelling at them. The answers were very interesting. Now, I guess a lot of them were just, well, it was conservative, then became a libertarian, kind of, basic sort of thing. Like they were a conservative, then they got to understanding the market part of it, and that ended up destroying their belief in the rest of conservatism. As can happen to you, lots of those, but you know what? There were lots that were all over the place. A lot of former liberals, a lot of former left radicals of one stripe or another. A lot of people who were, Rush Limbaugh clones, just, and that was, their words. You know what? I was 100% just whatever Rush said, he's God. I believe that. And then I think once it was, and then I became a Sarah Palinite, and then I learned about Ron Paul and economics, and now I'm an anarchist. And then some of them were saying, and now I'm like a bleeding heart libertarian, left-wing, so-called, I don't know those guys, libertarians. I believe in the minimum income, the guy said. That's a pretty powerful state you need for that. Anyway, so there are minarchists and anarchists of all stripes. You know what? You might want to look at this. I should find it here. Let's see, I will search in my little Twitter thing here. And, maybe this is only interesting if you're a, it's Book of Tamara is her Twitter handle. Maybe this is only interesting to Twitter people. It's just interesting to me to see how many people ended up being, I guess more or less individualist, anarchist, libertarians. The different paths that they all took to get there, all that kind of thing, anyway, interesting stuff. And here was the interestingly part to me was, people really can change. I forget that sometimes. I sort of feel like the whole show is just for Fitzy G and the boys in the chat room. You know what I mean? Same group of guys hanging out in the chat room after all these years. And, they come and they go, but mostly a lot of them are the same guys. And it sort of feels like a pretty small, tightly knit little thing here, but it's really not. There are thousands and thousands. And hey, Sneaker, I need some stats, dude. Get me some stats. There are untold thousands of people who listen, and there are new people coming and going all the time. Not everybody's going to dedicate their life to a foreign policy show from now on kind of thing. They come and they go. Even if they like it, they go, they move on with their lives. That's all right. But new people are coming around all the time. Young people are coming around all the time. Jeff Deist accused me of playing all oldies but goodies yesterday. And he's right. That's how old I am. The Public Enemy is oldies but goodies. Anyway, and so, yeah, you know, there are people who love Rush Limbaugh, but who might could get learned otherwise if I gave them half a chance. So, I should do that more. That's what I learned last night looking at that thing. Was, wow, look at all these people. We're talking 5-6 steps. Now, for me, I didn't answer because I thought, yeah, who's interested? And, you know, I'll save it for my show anyway, I guess, if it comes up, because maybe you guys. But I was always a libertarian, man. I mean, I liked the Republican hatred of the liberals and the hippies and stuff, I guess, when I was a kid. But I never really was a liberal, I don't think. And then I learned about libertarianism when I was only like 16 or something. I mean, yeah, big business is evil, but only because they can hire the government to kill you, right? And then I read Carol Quigley and The Creature from Jekyll Island, and I would read Will Grigg all the time. But I never was a right-winger. You know, I'd read like John Birchite propaganda, and I believed in the one-world government under the UN conspiracy theory type stuff too in the 90s. Mostly because Will Grigg said so. So, man, he sure seems to have his act together, you know? we both come a long way since then, I think. You know, I learned about Harry Brown in 96, so that was, I was just 1 year out of high school then. But in high school, I guess, I don't know what libertarian propaganda I was reading. But I never was a right winger, but I always hated the government more than big business, even though I always hated big business too. I figured out real young. Yeah, because I was in high school when I read None Dare Call It Conspiracy. And Gary Allen, he was a bircher, but Gary Allen was really a libertarian. And he was the kind of guy who put the political spectrum as a up and down. And the right is really no better than the left. They're all a bunch of statists. And think about that. Gary Allen getting away with teaching that to a bunch of birchers, you know? So, you know, that kind of thing always appealed to me, was just individualism over collectivism. Oh, and I guess I read a lot of Founding Fathers crap around that time, too. And Thomas Jefferson was pretty good on stuff when he was being good on stuff. So I learned a lot there. And then, once the war started, I finally got the internet and started reading LouRockwell.com and Antiwar.com. And I guess I'm more anarchist than Antiwar.com. I won't claim to be more anarchist than Lou, I don't guess. But now if I've made any transitions since then, I guess sort of I care less about ideology, but I never really cared that much about ideology. Like in a sense, I only pretend to believe in natural rights because I really can't prove it. I mean, maybe somebody, you know, smarter than me can somehow, you know, really win an argument and prove natural rights theory kind of thing. But I think it's just the kind of thing that you believe in if you'd prefer to live in a society where other people believe in it too, and how maybe if we all believe in natural rights, then we'll respect each other's rights a little bit, because just a bunch of crazy monkeys or fallen angels or some kind of halfway between heaven and hell type people here, aren't we? So that's my answer. Luke Skywalker, Ian. And actually, now, see, I guess he was more of a minarchist type, you know, Luke. But yeah, no, I'm more radical than that now. I guess I finally got over being a minarchist in about 2003. You know, I didn't really know that there were serious writers and economists and so forth who were libertarian anarchists. I thought the only anarchists were communist anarchists. Whenever I would ask them about anarchism, they would describe communism. And then, so, yeah, I guess I'm a limited republic guy. And then it wasn't until I started reading Rothbard that I... Oh, this guy Rothbard, man. Confessions of a Right-Wing Liberal. Have you ever read that? I read that in, like, 2003. I was like, ah, yeah. No, I love this stuff. So there's your answer, Tamer. I was always good on everything. But it's interesting to see other people's journeys. So, anyway... Oh, by the way, Brian McGlinchey's going to be here to talk about the Saudis doing 9/11 a bit, and the 28 pages, and Jordan Smith is going to debunk another capital murder case for you. Hang tight. You hate government? One of them libertarian types? Or maybe you just can't stand the president, gun grabbers, or warmongers? Me too. That's why I invented LibertyStickers.com. Well, Rick owns it now, and I didn't make up all of them, but still, if you're driving around and want to tell everyone else how wrong their politics are, there's only one place to go. LibertyStickers.com has got your bumper covered. Left, right, libertarian, empire, police state, founders quote, central banking. Yes, bumper stickers about central banking. Lots of them. And, well, everything that matters. LibertyStickers.com. Everyone else's stickers suck. Hey, y'all, Scott Horton here for Liberty.me, the social network and community-based publishing platform for the liberty-minded. Liberty.me combines the best of social media technology all in one place and features classes, discussions, guides, events, publishing, podcasts, and so much more. And Jeffrey Tucker and I are starting a new monthly show at Liberty.me, Eye on the Empire. It's just $4 a month if you use promo code Scott when you sign up. And hey, once you do, add me as a friend on there at scotthorton.liberty.me. Be free. Liberty.me.
Hey guys, welcome back. I got lots of things to talk about with you today on the show. All you conservatives and liberals and leftists who were just dying to become individualist anarchists like myself. Lots of things to talk about. First of all, so somebody wrote an essay about Israeli torture of Palestinians. Get this, hang around for the rest of this sentence. Are you ready? For CNN. She wrote the essay, they published it at CNN. How was she able to do so? She's an American. An American citizen. So, if you're an American citizen, even if you're a Palestinian, if you're an American citizen, and I guess they weren't Christians, they're Muslims too, then you count as, I guess, a half a person or something in comparison to an Israeli government employee. In this case, the child, an American citizen, again, beaten after he's already unconscious. The Israeli cops, I forget if they were soldiers or cops, same difference, continued to just beat the crap out of this kid really bad. And this was because the kid was protesting because they, some people had murdered his cousin, had lynched and murdered and burnt his cousin alive. And so he was out protesting about it, and they beat the crap out of him. And so she got to write this essay, and so she talked all about what the human rights groups have discovered about Israeli torture of minors in their custody. Talked with Philip Weiss the other day about how they're trying to, their new attorney general, their new justice minister, is trying to push a law to give kids sentences of 10 to 20 years for throwing rocks at the foreign soldiers occupying their land. But anyway, they absolutely brutalize these kids in Israeli jails. It's been documented time and again, over and over again. So I tweeted out complaining about that. And the Hasbara that came back was, oh, you're blinded by hatred. Can't talk about Israel on Twitter without getting the Hasbara back. You're blinded by hatred. And what am I blinded? What is it I'm not seeing? Some Israeli genetic engineers guys came up with grapes that grow in the winter, too. I mean, that's pretty good. I'm all for genetically engineering foods to grow in climates that were previously unacceptable. If you've never seen the Penn and Teller show BS about genetically engineered foods and all the lives that have been saved and stuff, it's really worth your time. But, oh, wow, now, geez, I almost forgot completely about the totalitarian prison conditions of the occupied children of the Gaza Strip, the ones who haven't been carted off to an Israeli prison to be tortured. I completely forgot about every other thing I know about Israel because, wow, grapes, huh? Are they seedless, too? I was so blinded by hate. You know what that reminds me of more than anything else? Is the refrain, stop me if you've heard this one, stop yourself if it was you saying it, from back in the days of George W. Bush. You just hate Bush. You just hate Bush. As though every policy and every decision this guy made were pure gold, and the only people who couldn't accept that were people who just had a pathological hatred of the man for no reason whatsoever. That's just where it starts. First you hate him, then you go trying to look for things to complain about, like fighting for Iran in Iraq for 8 years, derp. Which is wonderful and holy when it's a Bush doing it, don't you know? You're going to find that out again here in a minute. You just hate Bush. Really? Are you sure it's not just that I know 10 million things about what he's done and you know nothing? And I hate him because he deserves to be hated because he's a horrible, hateful, murderous person? Oh, you're blinded by hatred for Israel. Oh, yeah, that's right. You know what? 7 billion people in the world all just woke up hating Jews for being Jews, and all just woke up hating Israel for being Israel. It doesn't matter that there's an occupation, because, you know, if there wasn't an occupation, everybody would just hate Israel for being just great. That's what everybody on Earth hates so much. The seedless, all-year-round grapes of our betters. What a bunch of crap. Is that what you really tell yourselves, Zionists? That it's not the occupation? It's just, we hate you because you're free. We being everybody else. And I'm not talking about every man, woman, and child in Israel. I'm talking about, obviously, the government's policy here, but these things get conflated in these arguments, don't they? You just hate Bush. Okay, yes, I do hate him, but just hate him? Haha. Do you really want to get me started now? Yes, oh, I hate Benjamin Netanyahu. Absolutely, I hate Benjamin Netanyahu. But I don't just hate Benjamin Netanyahu. Why would I just hate Benjamin Netanyahu? Who starts out hating the prime minister of some foreign country? What do I have about him to hate? Except for the things that he does and the lies that he says. The murders he commits. Makes Adam Lanza look like a piker. What does that mean, a piker? Makes Adam Lanza look like he was just practicing for another day in the Gaza Strip, as an occupying soldier in the IDF. Ask him. We had the guy from Breaking the Silence on here last week. It's 2 weeks ago. It's just like the Winter Soldier testimony. IDF soldiers from just the last Gaza war from a year ago, not even. It's not really a war. A war is when two armies are fighting. As our teacher Bill Hicks explained, it was just a slaughter, a canned hunt. More than 500 killed kids. And the IDF soldiers came out and said, yeah, boy, the things we were doing were wrong. Let me get this off my chest. Yeah, a little bit of cognitive dissonance there. When you're taught that you're the very greatest of all, and then you go and act just like the so-called barbarians are slaughtering. Wait, who's the barbarian? I'm the one who was killing the kids, says the IDF artillery officer. So does that make me a bad guy? I'm thinking it might. You know what I did? I shot an artillery shell at a kid and exploded him to death. And now I'm thinking that maybe that was the wrong thing. Just following orders, though I was at the time. Go and read it. It's Breaking the Silence, man. It's all online. It's all straight out of the mouths of IDF soldiers. That's all it is. It's not a bunch of commentary. It's just their testimony. I'm so sick of that. You know what? Anti-Semitism hardly exists at all in this country. Okay? There are the Nazis, and then there's everybody else. When you hear people complaining about Israel, that doesn't mean that they're anti-Semitic at all. It probably just means they read a thing or two. Other than the New York Times.
Hey, y'all. Scott Horton here for WallStreetWindow.com. Mike Swanson knows his stuff. He made a killing running his own hedge fund and always gets out of the stock market before the government-generated bubbles pop. Which is, by the way, what he's doing right now, selling all his stocks and betting on gold and commodities. Sign up at WallStreetWindow.com and get real-time updates from Mike on all his market moves. It's hard to know how to protect your savings and earn a good return in an economy like this. Mike Swanson can help. Follow along on paper and see for yourself. WallStreetWindow.com.
Hey, y'all, guess what? You can now order transcripts of any interview I've done for the incredibly reasonable price of $2.50 each. Listen, finding a good transcriptionist is near impossible, but I've got one now. Just go to scotthorton.org/transcripts, enter the name and date of the interview you want written up, click the PayPal button, and I'll have it in your email in 72 hours max.
You don't need a PayPal account to do this. Man, I'm really going to have to learn how to talk more good. That's scotthorton.org/transcripts.
All right, you guys, welcome back.
I'm Scott. It's my show, the Scott Horton Show. And next up is our friend Brian McGlinchey from 28pages.org. Don't spell it out, 2-8. 28pages.org. Welcome back to the show. How are you doing?
Hey, it's great to be with you, Scott.
Good to have you here. Listen, I was thinking of you actually last night because I was reading this thing by old Eleanor Clift from the McLaughlin Group and Newsweek here at the Daily Beast. Rand Paul's New Crusade, the Secret 9/11 Docs. So first of all, for those just tuning in to politics for the first time in their lives, what 28 pages? What 9/11 Docs?
Back in the aftermath of the 9/11 attacks, most people are familiar with the 9/11 Commission. But before that, there was a joint congressional intelligence inquiry that looked into the activities of the intelligence community before and after 9/11. And they produced a 838-page document, and that was published. There were, you know, words and names and places redacted here and there, but President Bush decided that he needed to completely classify an entire 28-page chapter that is apparently about sources of foreign financial support of the 9/11 terrorists.
All right, now, that's pretty vague, but then again, it's been quite a few years and there have been quite a few leaks. Can you tell us what you think you know about what's in these 28 pages?
Yes, I'll tell you what Senator Bob Graham tells us. Senator Graham, former Democrat senator from Florida, he co-chaired that joint intelligence inquiry, and he's been one of the most outspoken in wanting them declassified. And he comes right out and says that the 28 pages deal with financial support of the 9/11 terrorists, and they point a, quote, very strong finger at Saudi Arabia as the principal financier, end quote.
All right, now, Greg Palast actually wrote a thing the other day after it was revealed that bin Laden had a copy of The Best Democracy Money Can Buy, which is, man, he's got some real scoops in that book. But it was, I think, a later book he includes this scoop that was on BBC Newsnight in November of 2001. And I've talked with Greg about this before. Some FBI agents came to him complaining, and they were pretty hot about it, that they had been told to back off the Saudis because the Saudis who the FBI were investigating for connections to terrorism were the same Saudis who were very close friends and business partners with the Bushes. And it was an embarrassing thing. And so, and these FBI agents told Palast they didn't think it was because they wanted the attack to happen or anything like that. It was because of those appearances. They just wanted to, hey, you know, you guys back off. Well, down the chain of command, that meant to a solid command, stop these investigations. And then as corroborating evidence, they showed him a document called 199I that was basically their permission to go ahead and begin investigating the Saudis again, dated a few days after 9/11. And so Greg actually just mentioned that again. So
yeah, there's anecdote after anecdote of all different manner of situations where people are told to back off or let's not put so much heat on Saudi Arabia. If you read Philip Sheehan's book, The Commission on the 9/11 Commission, you know, people were startled at the extent to which the Bush administration didn't want, you know, those angles being pursued. And, you know, now we're at a point where with this ongoing war on terror and, you know, the decisions about what's going to be done next in the Middle East, we continue to, it seems, turn a blind eye to, you know, the source of the problem. We keep talking about the symptoms and dealing with all that. But, you know, according to Bob Graham again, he says, you know, the suppression of these 28 pages and shielding Saudi Arabia from scrutiny for financing extremism and continuing to export it, you know, it enabled the rise of ISIS and all other types of problems, too. And so we're not really dealing with that.
Right. Now, the best article I've read about this, I got to mention, is Daniel Lazare wrote a thing for Bob Perry's site, consortiumnews.com.
where he really explains in pretty good detail about the relationship between the princes and the religious authorities and the foreign terrorist groups and the financing and this and that, certainly worth taking a look at. But I think it's already a proven fact in the documents, isn't it, that Prince Bandar's wife sent money, I believe approximately $100,000 or something like that, to, I think, directly to the guys in San Diego or to a relation of the guys in San Diego?
Yeah, indirectly, I think, through Omar Bayoumi out there.
Right. So, in other words, and of course, then there's the story that Bob Graham says, you know, and he was the chair of the Senate Intelligence Committee. Correct me if I'm wrong about that. I believe he was. And he said, you know what? The FBI never told us about this house full of Saudi royals in Florida that, you know, was obviously a huge anecdote in this story, a huge part of this. Well, a very important lead anyway, that some of the hijackers apparently were tied to this house and that the very rich and powerful Saudis who had been living in that house left, obviously, in a hurry with a car in the brand new car in the driveway and dinner on the table and all this kind of thing, left all their possessions behind and fled the country before the attack. And the FBI had kept that from Bob Graham. I mean, that alone has got to be a huge scandal just by itself. But anyway, so now the news, which is what?
Well, up to this point, the charge to declassify these 28 pages has been led in the House of Representatives by Congressman Walter Jones, Stephen Lynch, and Thomas Massie. And they have, for the past year and a half, been looking for a Senate counterpart to help you take up the charge there. And their ship came in. Rand Paul, along with Ron Wyden and Kirsten Gillibrand, yesterday introduced a Senate bill that would, by its language, require President Obama to declassify these 28 pages. So it's a huge step forward in terms of the profile of this issue, especially where you have a somebody with a spotlight like Rand Paul on that case.
Yeah, yeah, that's a huge thing. And, you know, as we can see, here's a story in the Daily Beast about it and this kind of thing. And, you know, anybody asks any questions, good ones or not, about 9/11, it's usually smeared as truth or nonsense. But then again, we're talking about 28 blacked out pages of a joint House Senate report. We all know, as you said, what the subject matter is, right, if not the details. And there's just kind of no denying it, as long as it's being brought up by these powerful and prominent senators. It's important news right there. And now, so the question is, for you and your judgment of watching what's going on up there, do you think there's much momentum that this could really be the make or break, and you think it'll make, or where are we at here?
I think it's, I mean, a critical driver of additional momentum. I think the 9/11 family members have been pursuing this for years and years, and I, you know, they're probably heartened to think that, wow, we've got yet a surge in interest on this, and high profile interest. There's a Freedom of Information Act lawsuit that's in progress right now. There is a mandatory declassification review process that's been initiated by Dan Christensen at the Florida Bulldog. He's the one who's been so good about investigating that Sarasota cell that you were talking about. Mm-hmm. So we've got a lot of avenues pointing at it now, a lot of, you know, increasing pressure. And, you know, I'm looking for help, and we're all looking for help on this, in terms of calling senators and giving them a hard time on this and telling them to co-sponsor that, this bill, which is Senate Bill 1471. And just to give a quick, the phone number to the House switchboard, it's 202-224-3121. A lot of these people have not even bothered reading the 28 pages.
Right. It's sitting right there for them to read, and they don't even care enough, but. But then again, you know, yeah, like you say, if we could just get them to read the thing, judging from the comments of some of the congressmen who have, they'll be animated about it. So there you go. Again, 202-224-3121. Call and harass your congressmen and senators about this. You say it's H.R. 1471. Is that right?
On the Senate side.
Senate side.
On the Senate side, it's Senate Bill 1471. On the House side, it's House Resolution 14.
All right, great. Thanks, Brian. 28pages.org, y'all.
Thank you.
Hey, all, Scott here. On average, how much do you think these interviews are worth to you? Of course, I've never charged for my archives in a dozen years of doing this, and I'm not about to start. But at patreon.com/ScottWhartonShow, you can name your own price to help support and make sure there's still new interviews to give away. So what do you think? 2 bits? A buck and a half? There are usually about 80 interviews per month, I guess, so take that into account.
You can also cap the amount you'd be willing to spend in case things get out of hand around here. That's patreon.com/Scott Horton Show. And thanks, y'all.
Hey, I'm Scott Horton here to tell you about this great new book by Michael Swanson, The War State. In The War State, Swanson examines how Presidents Truman, Eisenhower, and Kennedy both expanded and fought to limit the rise of the new national security state after World War II. This nation is ever to live up to its creed of liberty and prosperity for everyone. We are going to have to abolish the empire. Know your enemy. Get The War State by Michael Swanson. It's available at your local bookstore or at Amazon.com in Kindle or in paperback. Just click the book in the right margin at scotthorton.org or thewarstate.com.
Hey, I'm me. Welcome back to the thing here, guys. Oh, well, hang on. Well, we still got Brian McGlinchey on the line. Yeah, you know what? You're right. We should talk about that. Hey, Brian. Brian McGlinchey from 28pages.org. Keep you another couple of minutes here. Tell us about the how Rand Paul and them in the Senate are going about trying to actually get this thing through here. That is an important point.
Yeah, last week, you know, we knew that they were going to be introducing this bill, but at the press conference yesterday in Capitol Hill, the surprise twist came when Senator Paul said he was going to add this language as an amendment to next week's defense authorization bill. So whereas before we've been kind of plodding along trying to get support, you know, for these resolution one by one, now we've got something that's going to force at least some sort of action or debate or, you know, showdown procedurally, if nothing else, in the Senate chamber. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, now that's interesting. Now, does it take, do you know the rules of order of the Senate any better than me? Is it going to take 60 votes to do that or just 51?
Yeah, I don't know exactly what. Now, there's an interesting history to this because Senator Byron Dorgan back in 2003 attempted to do the same thing, attach language urging the declassification of the 28 pages to a bill. And he was shot down twice on procedural objections. And guess who was shooting him down? None other than Mitch McConnell.
Who, you know, I think that could mean then that, and maybe this is what you're trying to say, that, hey, maybe it'll be okay this time because Rand and Mitch McConnell work pretty well together. McConnell has endorsed him and Rand has cultivated him this whole time, really.
Well, it's interesting because, you know, that's my optimistic side. But then the other side says, well, Rand just thwarted McConnell's Patriot Act extension in dramatic, high-profile fashion. So we'll have to see how that plays out.
Yeah, you know what? I'm just making up stuff, but I think Rand must have said to him behind the curtain that, hey, listen, we're going to fight about this, but I still love you or whatever kind of thing, right?
So.
They didn't really get into a personal fight over the Patriot Act.
No, it didn't seem that way at all. It didn't seem that way.
Yeah, I think, you know, it was, we're going to go out there and we're going to take our opposite sides, but I think that they're probably still friends and that that went over okay, you know, at
right.
the end of the day. I hope so. Certainly for the sake of you know, this particular thing. And, you know, again, Rand Paul doing the right thing, and I don't know if this is the kind of thing that'll get him attacked by the war party. It's kind of hard for anybody to attack somebody for wanting to release these pages at this point, right? You don't have... or I don't know, but is even the Weekly Standard saying, oh, no, you'll reveal precious sources and methods at this point? Or is it just, you know,
I mean,
we just don't have the momentum enough yet, but there's nobody really standing against the declassification, other than the national security state itself. Am I right?
Right. Yeah, the opponents of this are all behind closed doors. There's no, you know, vocal advocate out there demanding that they stay shut. The American Enterprise Institute had a piece a few months back by one of their writers, and I can't remember his name, but he's actually a veteran of the I think Office of Special Plans from the 2000 the Iraq War era. I mean, he of all people was arguing that, hey, these 20 pages should come out, and we should make it a campaign issue, you know, during the upcoming presidential race. So that's a good sign as well.
Well, I don't know, man. That's kind of scary because. I wouldn't want to see the agenda switch to let's, you know, demonize and go after and maybe even get in a war with the Saudis. I guess we can't expect them to align that tightly with Iran at this point, can we? Especially not Jeb.
Well, and looking at it as a potential presidential issue, you've got, you know, people have said that this could be very embarrassing to the Bush administration, you know, because it will paint, you know, the ties and the fact that, you know, what did the Bush administration, you know, decide to conceal from the American public if it actually, you know, does, as Senator Graham say, point to Saudi Arabia. And so, you know, it could be some, you know, a decrease in the goodwill of the Bush name as that name is, you know, in the race for the presidential nomination.
Yeah, I mean, it does seem pretty obvious, or at least it's the most obvious interpretation for the media would be, oh, well, you know, Bandar and Bush are close. And, geez, there's Bandar smoking cigars with Bush on the White House balcony just a couple of days later. I guess they probably won't want to get into all that, but...
Yeah, but ultimately, I think this is about, you know, Thomas Massie made the point that every day Congress is making decisions about what do we do in this war on terror? How do we prevent the next 9/11? Do we need to vacuum up every American citizen's personal information? Do we need to be intervening overseas? He says all the while, some of the best intelligence we have on this topic is in these 28 pages. And most people on Capitol haven't even bothered reading it, and that they're pretending to be informed on this topic and making some very critical decisions without complete information. That's, to me, what this issue is really about.
Yeah, you know, absolutely. That's a huge flaw in having such secrecy, especially surrounding such important, you know, history-altering policies. None of these guys know what they're talking about. I mean, we're in a giant... well, not we are, but the U.S. started, and now there is in the Middle East right now a massive civil war between, you know, a proxy war, really, between Tehran and Riyadh. And America's fighting on both sides of the dang thing. And we have the leaders of the war party are on the Israeli side, i.e. the Saudi side, the Sunni side. Against the Iranians, as though the Iranians are the greater threat, when it was Al-Qaeda that attacked us, and as it seems to be implied here, virtually at least, the state of Saudi Arabia that attacked us. And yet, we've been fighting for our one group of enemies, and calling them our friends, while we're fighting for our other group of enemies and calling them our enemies, but fighting for them anyway. And all this madness, anyway, like you're saying, as mad as it is, we'd have a lot more clarity about who's who and why it is our government's doing what it's doing or what it should be doing if we had answers to some of these questions, you know?
That's right. And that's the point Senator Graham's making, is that, you know, this is a republic. And in a republic, you know, the will of the people is based on them being an informed people and able to supervise the actions of their government.
Right. In fact, you know, I read a thing the other day where it was in the National Review where the guy was saying Rand Paul was right about something. I don't know what was the connection. And then trying to spin it all because Iran is behind Al-Qaeda and always has been. What? Oh, man. The kinds of spin that they can get away with. And you know what? Rand has done this, too, complaining and saying the enemy is radical Islam and not trying to differentiate when we have the Islamic Republic in Iran locked in a war right now with the Islamic State in Iraq. and you know, they want to conflate those things together when, in fact, they're all quite different. So, yeah, I don't know. Certainly it would be interesting to see if this stuff did come out, Brian, just how much the narrative would have to change as far as TV goes and as far as our politicians go. But I think
we do owe a great credit to Senator Paul for taking the lead on this issue, because bringing up 9/11 can be a risky issue for politicians, because there are so many people who falsely attribute bringing that up to, you know, being a fringe topic, when no, it absolutely goes to the very core of the war on terror and our conduct of our foreign policy. So he put himself out there. And so I think on this issue, we need to be grateful.
Yeah, no, I appreciate that. And of course, you know, he's got the great argument, which is, hey, this is what the House and Senate staff wrote about what the CIA and the FBI told them. So, you know, sorry, but this is our government intelligence and police agencies' official position on the truth of that matter, and the American people deserve it. There's not much of an argument to have the other way, you know?
Now, as he pursues his bill, it'll be interesting. You know, back in 2003, 46 senators sent a letter to George W. Bush demanding that the 28 pages be released. 11 of them are still around. One of them's Wyden, and he's on board. But we'll have to see whether these other 11 sign on to this bill.
You said Charles Schumer was one of those, right?
Exactly. Charles Schumer actually, you know, led the case, you know, was very vocal, very strident in saying these need to come out. And until we do, we're not going to be able to change the behavior of those people who are supporting terrorism. So we'll see if these people are consistent on principle and step behind.
Yeah. Oh, I'm sorry. I didn't mean to interrupt. Just we were talking about Charles Schumer, right? Yeah.
Right, and that we'll see if he's consistent, and others are consistent on principle, and they demanded it from President Bush. They should also be demanding it from President Obama.
Yeah. Well, I think it's great work that you're doing here in trying to get people to focus on this issue, and you've really had a hell of a lot of success so far in getting this ball rolling and continuing to push it too. So you deserve a lot of credit for that.
All credit's really to Congressman Jones, Massey, and Lynch, but I'm just trying to do my best to help facilitate awareness of it and getting people to call that House switchboard at 202-224-3121 and ask their senator to support Senate Bill 1471.
All right, great. Senate Bill 1471, 202-224-3121. Thanks again, Brian.
Thanks so much.
All right, y'all, that's Brian McGlinchey. He's at 28pages.org.
Hey, you own a business? Maybe we should consider advertising on the show. See if we can make a little bit of money. My email address is scott@scotthorton.org.
Hey, I'm Scott Horton here for The Future of Freedom, the monthly journal of the Future Freedom Foundation at fff.org/subscribe. Since 1989, FFF has been pushing an uncompromising moral and economic case for peace, individual liberty, and free markets. Sign up now for The Future Freedom, featuring founder and president Jacob Hornberger, as well as Sheldon Richmond, James Bovard, Anthony Gregory, Wendy McElroy, and many more. It's just $25 a year for the print edition, $15 per year to read it online. That's fff.org/subscribe. And tell them Scott sent you.
I really should tell my guests for the top of the hour that I'll call it a few minutes after. Somehow I think they'll just wait around, probably. I don't know. All right, I got Jordan Smith on the line. She is the legendary and heroic investigative journalist from the Austin Chronicle. Boy, did she debunk the yogurt shop murders and the story of Rodney Reed, who his death sentence has been postponed, although I don't think commuted. Now here she... Oh, and she did the one about... The murder in Las Vegas, very, very good one there. And now this one is about a guy named Lester Bauer, who was convicted of murder way back in 1984 and sentenced to death. And he still hadn't been executed, and we're going to see whether he is or not. Welcome back to the show, Jordan. How are you doing?
I'm great. Thanks for having me.
Very happy to have you on the show. So who is Lester Leroy Bauer, and what did he do?
That's the question, right? So Lester Bauer was a family man who was living in a suburb of Dallas back in the early 80s, chemical salesman, never been in trouble with the law before, kind of got interested in ultralight flying, those little fixed-wing aircraft that were kind of big back in the day, mm-hmm. that are kind of propelled by lawnmowers, motors. And he wanted to buy one. His wife didn't want him to, so he kind of went behind her back and went to go buy this ultralight aircraft from a guy out in Grayson County, which is sort of near the Oklahoma state line. And the day after he's there to buy the aircraft, four men who were in the airplane hangar where he went to purchase it wound up dead, shot execution style in the head and left under a piece of carpeting in the hangar. So he was eventually convicted of killing those four men. Mm-hmm. That's the short of it.
All right. Well, now, so first of all, hey, he was there. He admits
right.
He admits that he lied about whether he was there or not. Got
exactly.
A problematic problem right there.
Right.
A couple of problematic problems. So so what else did they have on him? Because they must have had more than that.
Yeah, because for some reason, and it's still not entirely clear to me, but the FBI got involved very early on in this investigation. And so the FBI found that he had, had called one of these men several times. And when they came to talk to him about it, he initially lied about it. Then he ultimately admitted that he had talked to the guy, but denied also being out at the hangar and denied having purchased, having taken the ultralight, which, of course, he did that as well. Now, he says he lied because he was afraid. He's like, oh, my God, I left and then these guys are killed. Maybe the killer saw me. I have two young daughters. I don't know. I don't want to put our family in jeopardy. That's the reason he said he lied. But the state said that he was also implicated because there was some supposedly rare .22 ammunition, this Fiocchi ammunition, which is Italian, that were the shell casings were found at the scene. And so they said, Bauer, who is a federally licensed firearms dealer, was one of the few people who in America who had purchased this ammunition. So that kind of drew a direct line between him and the murder. And so he was tried, and basically that was it. He didn't have a very stellar defense, at least by, you know, on the plain face of it. He really wanted to testify at his trial and explain why he lied and explain that he, you know, actually went there legitimately to buy the thing. And his defense attorney, very early on, just like 2 days after Bauer was arrested in January of 1984, adopted a strategy that he maintained throughout the trial, which was, my client was never in Grayson County. And so that became sort of untenable because they could show that he had lied, you know, about being there. And so the defense strategy was he wasn't there. And so if he wasn't there, then he can't testify in his own defense. So they sort of blocked his ability to testify. And so that combined with this ammunition, which he did actually had purchased this ammunition, and the fact that he had pieces of the ultralight and had been at the hangar, all is very compelling. And I'm not really surprised that a jury, given only that information, would find him guilty.
Mm-hmm. All right. Well, so what's changed since 1984?
So a lot has changed since 1984. So in the intervening years, he has a defense team now that have been working pro bono on his case for 26 years, which is just kind of mind-blowing if you think about it. But about 5 years after he was convicted and sentenced to death, his defense team began to get some documents from the FBI that were never released to the defense. So it was a clear Brady violation. They did not release information that they're required by law to release. And that is essentially that the FBI knew that this Fiocchi ammunition was far less rare than the state had presented at trial, and that Les Bauer was hardly one of the only people to buy it. They also kind of had drawn at trial this like sort of picture that this Fiocchi ammunition is used only for killing people, when they know actually the FBI documents that later came out starting in about 89 and 90 revealed that is actually marketed for use as small game hunting and for target practice and all the kinds of things that most ammunition is used for. So there's that. Another thing happened too is what a woman in North Texas read an article about Bauer's attorneys filing an appeal of his case and realized that she knew who the actual murderers were and that Les Bauer was not one of them. And so this woman, whose identity has been protected by the courts, she's known sort of in the papers as Pearl. Pearl came forward to say that in 1983 she was in a relationship with a known drug dealer, and that he had basically confessed to having committed these murders along with several other friends. She overheard conversations that they had about it, and she's remained remarkably consistent in her story since 1989 till now. The courts have heard that, but they've sort of been like, not that compelling, even though her story has also actually been corroborated by other people, including by the wife of one of these alternate suspects, who said that she too knew that her husband had been involved. And also, one of the alleged actual perpetrators told a defense investigator at some point that he, in the 1980s, owned Fiocchi ammunition, which he used with his .22. So there's three compelling alternate theory, and that the murders, they alleged that the murders were committed over a drug deal gone wrong, that one of the man who was actually selling the ultralight plane, had been involved in drug dealing, and that this was just really the result of a bad drug deal, which in a way makes a little bit more sense.
Yeah, rather than this seemingly normal guy with no criminal history murdered four men in cold blood to steal their ultralight.
Yeah, I mean, exactly. I can see why they would convict him based on the stuff they had, because it's like, that's crazy, you know, that sounds terrible. What a callous and horrible.
Right.
But it's a far less sort of, you know, compelling narrative than the alternative, which is drug deal gone bad.
Right.
Execution-style hits.
Yeah,
done,
it makes it that much worse when this story doesn't make sense at all. Why, he must just be a monster to do such a thing.
Right, exactly. You're right. You got it. That's
perfect
exactly
spin.
It.
Yeah. Now, I think you got to the answer to the question of why was the FBI involved all along is because they knew what was going on with this local drug ring. Maybe they were investigating it. Maybe one of the dead guys was one of their guys.
Well, that's a compelling possibility. I don't know that there's any thing to suggest that that one of the dead men was related to the FBI. However, two of the men were actually former law enforcement officers. So that's, you know, and that's the other thing actually that people point to the idea that Bauer was the doer is sort of impossible, right? Because you have this man up, Les Bauer is a big guy at the time. He was about, you know, 6 feet tall, about 250 pounds. But the idea that he would come in on his own and be able to take down four men in an airplane hangar, two of whom are former law enforcement, with sort of these double taps to the head, and it's sort of, again, it's kind of a little unbelievable. I don't know how he'd get the drop on four guys, two of whom are, you know, arguably trained in how to deal with aggressive threats, right?
Yeah. You know, I'm curious about in the prosecution, well, now we got to go to break. I'll ask him a question about the prosecution. I need to do better with that clock. It's Jordan Smith from no longer the Austin Chronicle. Now she's at The Intercept, and this one is about a guy on death row named Lester Bauer who might not have done it and might get killed for it anyway. Hang tight.
Don't you get sick of the Israel lobby trying to get us into more wars in the Middle East? Or always abusing Palestinians with your tax dollars? It once seemed like the lobby would always have full-spectrum dominance on the foreign policy discussion in D.C. But those days are over. The Council for the National Interest is the America lobby, standing up and pushing back against the Israel lobby's undue influence on Capitol Hill. Go show some support at councilforthenationalinterest.org. That's councilforthenationalinterest.org.
All right, guys. I'm on the phone with Jordan Smith, investigative reporter for The Intercept. And we're talking about the case of this guy, Lester Bauer. Death penalty case. He's been on death row since 1984, and he's almost at the end of his line, and yet all kinds of new evidence has come out. But the question I wanted to ask you when we had to go to break there, Jordan, was about, I wonder, when you said there two of the victims were former cops, I wonder how much that featured in the prosecution, you know, in their narrative of the story, that these are, you know, our heroes, our valiant guys, or whatever. And only because it's always curious to me when I see cases where innocent people get convicted of killing cops, because it seems like if they're ever going to try real hard to make sure that they got the right guy, it would be when it's one of their own gets killed. But it seems like they're always just perfectly happy to prosecute whoever they can get rather than the guy that maybe actually really did the thing, even when it's their own, you know, brother in blue and all that. Oh, and I better turn your mic on so people can hear you. Go ahead. I'm sorry.
No, in reading the trial, you know, it's interesting. They didn't actually play up the former law enforcement angle very much. But to be honest with you, I don't know that they would have had to, because it's a very small community. So I think a lot of people kind of had a sense of who these people were, and it didn't need to be hammered on. But I think your point is absolutely right. And I think part of the problem with our capital system is stuff like this happens, right? If we're going to have a capital system, then it would be very advantageous to have all the questions answered before we put someone to death. And here, it's just troubling because there's this, you know, really far more plausible, it seems to me, alternate storyline that the courts have considered and have found compelling. I mean, they're, you know, in a court ruling, one of the state judges who heard all this evidence the most recent time, which I think was in 2012, he ruled that, yeah, this is compelling stuff, but it doesn't clearly demonstrate that Les Bauer is actually innocent, and so therefore, you know, kind of no harm, no foul. There's nothing we can do.
Right, because now that he's convicted,
right,
the burden of proof is on him by some supermajority standard, rather
right,
than
exactly
the way it's at least supposed to work in a Pettit jury trial, right?
You're right. Absolutely. Now there is
so he doesn't just have to say. Now, I mean, this is an important thing because this threshold is so high. This legal threshold is so high. I mean, they're going to kill this guy,
right?
And he's got. He's got a wife and a girlfriend, I think you said, who, you know, say that, yeah, the actual people confessed to me that they did it, told me all about it, told me about the nightmares they had about it, all this stuff. And a judge even said, yeah, hey, that sure sounds like.
That's pretty compelling.
Yeah, that might well be what happened, but you would have to satisfy, the lawyers would have to satisfy the judge that there is no effing way he could have been convicted if only his lawyers had been allowed to put on this defense. Right. And anything short of that, and he hangs.
Right. So you have a couple of things. One, with the Brady violations, the withholding of the evidence, and also the claim that this defense attorney was, you know, ineffective and rendered a pretty crappy defense. You know, the bar is, you have to prove that stuff was there. But not only that, but for that misconduct, the outcome of your trial would have been different. And essentially, that's a really, really high standard to meet, right? So, like, if the state can say, well, you know, no, it wasn't really that important, and that's usually what wins the day. And as to the, you know, proving he's innocent, it has to be, yeah, clear and convincing, and kind of has to, you know, overcome this idea that this other maybe not as plausible theory, but the one that the state advanced is just demonstrably wrong. And so, yeah, it's a really, really difficult hurdle to overcome. But, you know, there is one could get some relief. I mean, this is his 8th execution date. And unless the Supreme Court steps in, he will be executed tonight after 6 p.m. in Texas. So, but there is another kind of little wrinkle, which is that he was sentenced here under an old sort of sentencing scheme that didn't allow for a real way for jurors to take, you know, advantage or to consider mitigating evidence. And so the courts have kind of gone back and forth on whether Les Bauer should be granted a new sentencing hearing. Actually, the district court ruled that he should, and the appeals courts have said no. So it's really up to the Supreme Court now. And this question has come to them once before on Bauer's case, and the majority denied his relief. But three of the justices wrote a very compelling dissent as to why he should be granted the relief, and we're kind of back up there again with the same question today. So it'll be interesting to see if that three-judge dissent can turn itself into a majority.
Mm. And then still, as important as that is, right, for his lawyers to be able to say, hey, this is a friend of the community, always has been, whatever, he's not some kind of serial killer or whatever, et cetera, for him to not be able to make that case before and for him to have the chance to make that case now, that's important. I could see that. But still, as huge as it is, it's just a technicality. But when it comes to even the Supreme Court, the threshold for him having to prove his innocence here is no different. Do I understand that right?
Well, absolutely. You're absolutely right. And it's even a little bit more, it gets even more confusing on the federal, once you get to the federal level. But it is worth pointing out that if he can get this new punishment hearing, that I think that, well, first of all, it's hard, you know, I think they'd maybe be able to bring some information in that may be able to be a little bit more convincing to jurors. And at the very least, although it's not ideal, obviously, it spares him his life. And so maybe that affords him some opportunity to fight on and try to prove that he wasn't the one that actually did this. So, I mean, while it's not ideal, it does spare him.
Mm. And now, I believe you said in here that you did get comment from his defense lawyer at the time, at one point, right? And he refused to concede that he'd made any serious mistake in his strategy here. Is that right?
He was called. I didn't talk to him. He was called actually as a witness in an appeal based on the ineffective assistance of counsel, and he testified that he did a good job. He testified about all the reasons why he adopted the strategy he did. He sort of denied that he failed to do investigation. He denied, you know, he denied basically all the allegations that he was ineffective and that he was deficient in his defense of Les Bauer. And the state of Texas, of course, has agreed with the defense attorney's self-assessment of his own work. Mm-hmm. Because of what we were talking before, because of the kind of really high burden to show that that what he did wasn't actually reasonable, that's why he hasn't gotten relief on it, because the courts have said, well, you know, he says he didn't do a bad job, and, you know, it looks like he might have had some reason for doing what he did. It was his strategy, and we can't hard to overcome legal strategy decisions, and that's essentially where that kind of lays.
Yeah. Well, and of course, because all the judges are lawyers too, all these guys are, you know, more or
less
together.
Very good point. And of course,
you know, the truth and the justice of all this gets completely lost in those kinds of politics, unfortunately.
Absolutely.
Yeah. All right. Now, so, yeah, I guess really that's a good enough place to end it. And hey, there's some music anyways. The lawyer refusing to take responsibility for putting on a completely easily disprovable defense that he wasn't even there when he admitted he was there, but, just under different circumstances. I mean, I don't know. If I was a judge, I would say that would be reason enough for review right there. But anyway, just goes to show. Thank you, Jordan. Great work as always.
Hey, thanks so much for having me. I always like to be on.
Great. That's Jordan Smith. She's at The Intercept. Hey, all, Scott Horton here. It's always safe to say that one should keep at least some of your savings in precious metals as a hedge against inflation. And if this economy ever does heat back up and the banks start expanding credit, rising prices could make metals a very profitable bet. Since 1977, Robertson Roberts Brokerage, Inc. has been helping people buy and sell gold, silver, platinum, and palladium, and they do it well. They're fast, reliable, and trusted for more than 35 years. And they take Bitcoin. Call Robertson Roberts at 1-800-874-9760 or stop by rrbi.co. Yeah, man, welcome back. I'm Scott. All right, that was Jordan Smith again. Firstlook.com/The Intercept for this story. They're going to kill him tonight if the Supreme Court doesn't stop him. On a technicality, a question of whether his sentencing hearing was fair or not. You know, plenty of reasonable doubt as far as I'm concerned. Sure does seem like it. So, yeah, man. Here's another thing at The Intercept today. It's by Glenn Greenwald. I wanted to make sure I mention this, and since I have it here. In Boston, media again trash a police shooting victim by uncritically, quote, reporting police accusations. First, they said the guy was armed with a machete. You might have heard me yesterday when I interviewed, God, I forgot her name already. I'm sorry, the sister of the guy that the cops killed last week. Gada Murad was her name. Faraz. Faraz was her brother that the cops murdered. And I mentioned how, you know, it's obvious he's wearing no shirt. It's obvious he doesn't have a gun in his waistband. He's not carrying a machete like the guy they claimed, like what they claimed about the guy they killed today. And then guess what? His machete was just a buck knife. That's all. Oh, a buck knife. Yeah, it's not a crime to have a buck knife. A military-style black knife. I love the way Greenwald writes this. Not just any knife, but a black one. A black knife. An Africanized honey knife. Wild and dangerous. Anyway, they murdered the hell out of this guy, and then they say, oh, yeah, no, he was totally a terrorist. He was friends with ISIS. He was going to murder some cops. He was actually going to cut cops' heads off with that knife. And how do we know this? Anonymous sources say so. NBC Nightly News, apparently. Top story. Oh, my God, everybody. Check out a bunch of claims of a bunch of line killers. Oh, yeah, we're so impressed. The entire media, but Greenwald, who points out that, hey, not so fast. Anyway, take a look at that. You know, they seem to be bringing on more and more really good people there. It took them a while to get it going. I don't know. They had their hiccups, but it seems like they're getting a lot of good work done there at The Intercept. I don't know if they're getting enough traffic or what, you know. I bet you the Austin Chronicle misses Jordan Smith. I'll tell you what. All right. Now, so listen, man, I'm sorry. When I was going on and on about you just hate Bush and you just hate Israel and all that crap earlier, I meant to talk about how there's some really important stuff going on here on the Israel issue. For liberals, conservatives, Jewish and Gentile and everybody else to understand and grapple with in this country. And I think that this article, well, this treatment by Philip Weiss of an interview of Jeffrey Goldberg by David Rothkopf. Oh, God, spare me, Scott Horton, for God's sake. So there's David Rothkopf of Foreign Policy, who is quite objectionable on Iran. I was surprised to hear how anti-Zionist he was, as mentioned by Philip Weiss here. But here he is. He's interviewing Jeffrey Goldberg, Corporal Goldberg, Commissar Goldberg, the guy who lied you into war with Iraq on a bunch of claims about friendship and ties between Saddam and Osama in the New Yorker, which were all lies. And, of course, who has appointed himself the role of deciding which journalists or which commentators or which who or what is anti-Semitic or not, and who's allowed to be accepted in mainstream discourse or not. He's a really terrible guy. He's also, in the important part of this article, is very interesting on some things. And that's because, well, this is what's interesting about him to me. If you page down a bit, I don't care about the Obama part. But if you page down a bit, you get to Jeffrey Goldberg's pretty right-wing nationalist Zionist anti-Netanyahu position. And I think it's only because it's so obvious. Come on, man. And that is now the position of Jeffrey Goldberg at The Atlantic. Is, hey, the Israeli government is destroying Israel. They are painting Israeli society into a corner where it can only be a minority-ruled apartheid state and still be a Jewish state. Or it can be democratic and not be a Jewish state anymore, which that seems to me like only fair anyway. But still, from the Zionist point of view, Netanyahu and his cohorts are extremely short-sighted. If you take the whole West Bank and East Jerusalem and just make them officially Israel, which they pretty much are anyway, two-state solution is about as dead as can be, and so what does that leave us? Occupied territory with no hope that it'll ever be negotiated away to be autonomous or independent at all. So what of all the people who live there? Are they just going to massacre them all? Or they're going to end up being a minority Jewish state, like white apartheid South Africa? And right now, they're right at the line. You know, I guess I don't have a primary footnote, but I've got a great secondary footnote, which was Flint and Hillary Mann Leverett, who were citing the map that if you take all the Palestinian Israelis, you take all the occupied people of the Golan Heights, the West Bank, and East Jerusalem, they already are a majority, like maybe a bare majority. But the day has come. I mean, you know what? No matter what you think about Jimmy Carter, you know he's a kind old guy, right? When he says peace, not apartheid, he's not, I mean, what are we supposed to think? That he's some, you know, gray wool coat wearing goose-stepping Nazi? That he's just an anti-Semite? That how dare he call people names like that? Of course not. Just listen to what he says. He says, man, you guys are screwing up your own thing here. Friends don't let friends drive drunk. What the hell are you doing? Your mandate is a Jewish democratic state. Now, that was achieved by ethnically cleansing the land of all the Arabs. 750,000 of them. So that was some cruel crap, and there are a lot of refugees still living in horrible camps all around the region right now. It's a catastrophe. You can include Gaza as one of those camps. But even excluding the right of return doesn't mean that they gotta occupy all the Palestinians in East Jerusalem, the West Bank, and the Gaza Strip, the Golan Heights for that matter. They never get thrown in, do they? I don't know much about who lives in the Golan Heights. Mostly Druze, I guess. Anyway, so here's Jeffrey Goldberg. I guess I skipped past the paragraph I'm looking for. If current trends continue. Oh, and listen, here's the context of what they're talking about, too. Is, God, look how the time flies, sorry. Is about Jews in America. Jews in America are liberals in super duper majorities, right? I mean, we're talking like blacks vote Democrat, Jews vote Democrat in this country by super duper majorities, like 80 something percent. And they have liberal principles. Like, they helped with the civil rights movement as best they could. It applied to them, too, in this country. And they just don't believe and cannot support. They don't believe in and cannot support the way the Israelis treat the Palestinians, especially now that all pretensions are over, that this is somehow temporary, this occupation. So then Goldberg says, and I'm going to have no time to say it. Is that the music right there? Already. If current trends continue, a civil war is coming. It will be a very civil war. No, it won't. It would be horrible. But it will still be a civil war between an American Jewry that has been nurtured on the values of the civil rights movement and an Israeli Jewry that has been taught harshly that the Middle East is no place for mercy. Jeffrey Goldberg's words there. Hey, all Scott here. If you're like me, you need coffee. Lots of it. And you probably prefer it tastes good, too. Well, let me tell you about Darren's Coffee Company at darrenscoffee.com. Darren Marion is a natural entrepreneur who decided to leave his corporate job and strike out on his own, making great coffee. And Darren's Coffee is now delivering right to your door. Darren gets his beans direct from farmers around the world. All specialty, premium grade, with no filler. Hey, the man just wants everyone to have a chance to taste this great coffee. darrenscoffee.com. Use promo code Scott and you get free shipping. darrenscoffee.com.
Yeah, goddamn show's almost over already. Can you believe that? That's not fair. I got a bunch of other stuff I got to go do, so you got to do it. All right, I'm going to have to skip that. No time. That's an entire segment or two worth of ranting right there. Oh, man. Let me tell you this. Yesterday I mentioned it on the show, and I'm an honest guy. I think I told you. I hadn't read it yet, but you need to know that it exists. Well, now I read it. It's really good. It reads almost like a transcript of this show, only with proper grammar and punctuation. Great essay by Dan Sanchez. That's the highest praise, by the way. I ain't accusing him of nothing. Dan Sanchez, great new writer at antiwar.com. He runs the Mises Academy at the Ludwig von Mises Institute, where they're the only correct economics professor types that you can find around. Everyone else is some kind of communist or fascist, except for them. At Mises.org. I don't think that's their official slogan. But yeah, pretty much. Okay. Salafists gaining ground throughout the Middle East, thanks to U.S. intervention. And it's a great write-up by Dan Sanchez. And I say that so I don't have to go into all the arguments in there. You got to do just a little bit of homework. It'll really help catch you up, though, man, if you need it. Would you do it? Salafists Gaining Ground by Dan Sanchez. It's at antiwar.com right there in the margin. He's our newest regular columnist there. Because I says to him, I says, hey, you want to be a regular columnist at antiwar.com? And he said, yeah, okay. So that was the deal that we made, and so now he is. Okay, now check it out. The reason I tell you that is because I got to tell you about this. The New York Times and Bernard. Now, it's interesting because I've actually read some things by her that I thought were some pretty decent journalism before. But I am so sick and tired of this ridiculous conspiracy quackery, this spin that, oh yeah, you know, Assad and ISIS are allies against the rebels. No, ISIS are the rebels. ISIS is Al-Qaeda in Iraq. That's all it is. Al-Qaeda in Iraq. And when the rebellion started, they were the ones who started it. And when the civil war there raged, they were the ones who were fighting it. And they have been. Right now, these guys are trying to rehabilitate the al-Nusra Front, which is al-Qaeda in Syria, which are still sworn loyal to Ayman al-Zawahiri, the butcher of New York City, successor to Osama bin Laden. And they're saying, oh yeah, and you know, Nusra and the moderates, these mythical moderates, why, they're the rebels, and Assad and ISIS are the alliance against them. Well, what is ISIS? ISIS is nothing but al-Nusra, only under a different chain of command. They were al-Nusra. If you take al-Qaeda in Iraq from 2006, some of them are Syrians, some of them are Iraqis. Well, the faction that was more dominated by the Iraqis went back to Iraq, declared a caliphate. That includes about half of Syria, too. And the side that was mostly made up of Syrians stayed in Syria and has fought against Assad.
And as I keep mentioning to you, because it's very important, there's a piece in The Guardian all about Stanley Cohen, the radical left-wing Jewish civil rights lawyer, my favorite kind, you know, the kind of guys who will, you know, fight and sue, like Greenwald, who will fight and sue for the right of Nazis to have free speech, because if Nazis don't have free speech, ain't nobody's got free speech, that kind of thing. Real principled Bill of Rightsy type guys. The kind of guys in the Civil War with the Zionists that we were just talking about in the last segment, in fact. Like Greenwald is another great example of that. But anyway, he was negotiating for the release of one of the American hostages by the Islamic State. And in the process of his negotiating the release, which it ultimately failed, I'll tell you why in a second, in the process of negotiating the release, he was negotiating a healing of the rift between the Islamic State and al-Nusra. And between one religious leader, the al-Qaeda religious leader living in Jordan, and his student, who was one of the top, you know, Islamic scholars justifying the caliphate. And Cohen... And he was trying to do a good thing and get this hostage release. He was a hair away from healing the rift between these guys. Because that's the difference between them. A teacher and a student. Former factions of the exact same suicide bomber, head shop, and terrorist that America was fighting in the last war. And I don't mean the Sunni-based insurgency. I mean al-Qaeda in Iraq, the smallest part of it. The worst part of it. And now here, in the New York Times, Assad's forces may be aiding new ISIS surge. Oh, they may be. Right in the headline, it's And then what is it that they're doing? They're restraining themselves from attacking the Islamic State while the Islamic State is attacking their rival insurgents who have been making massive gains against the Syrian government lately. Well... The enemy of my enemy, they have no evidence that they explain in this article anywhere that the enemy of Assad's enemy in ISIS is his friend. Just that he's not attacking them while they are attacking people who have been attacking him. Oh, well, yeah, you know what? That's basically just a hop, skip, and a backside ollie from, you know, Assad created the Islamic State just to hurt the good rebels. Yeah, no, he loves them. He is them. The Islamic State works for Assad. Yeah, yeah, yeah. Are you sure that you don't mean the United States of America and its allies, Saudi and Qatar and Kuwait and Turkey and Israel, are supporting the terrorists directly to the FSA, which is just really one hop, skip, and a just one step is all, not even a... Hop, one step removed from al-Nusra. And in effect, ISIS too, because there are all kinds of claims and quotes from ISIS guys saying, yeah, we buy weapons from the FSA, the Free Syrian Army, mythical moderates all the time. Yeah, thanks for the weapons. Here's some money. America's giving weapons to the moderates. The Saudis are giving these guys money to buy the weapons with. How deniable. Let's blame it all on Assad for resisting. And of course, yeah, he's a fascist dictator and was long before this ever started. And he's waged war against civilian populations because he's a fascist dictator. I ain't no fan of his either. But for America, for America to go from Bill Clinton and George Bush's policy, which was paying this guy to torture and murder jihadists for us, to then backing the jihadists against him, if, you know, both sides are equally evil, the latter is crazier. And the first kind of policy is what got us into this mess in the first place, really, of course. Not that Assad was ever a loyal sock puppet like Hosni Mubarak kind of guy, but he did work for Bill Clinton and George Bush in limited context. But anyway, this has just been going on for years. This is the kind of thing you read Roy Guttman trying to pretend all the time, too. Or, you know, he doesn't try to pretend. I mean, it's a... It's all a doublethink in his mind if you read what he writes at McClatchy about this, too. You know, Nusra and their allies have been relentlessly attacking and making major gains against the government. The Islamic State comes and moves in on the territory they've gained. So they push back against that, and Assad doesn't stop them from pushing back against ISIS. Ooh, ooh, collaboration with ISIS. Give me a break. Is that working on people in your brains where your thinking goes on? Maybe if you only just fell off the turnip truck, but otherwise, I don't know, man. Ain't working on me. Go read Dan. Dan's got it straight right now at antiwar.com. Salafists gaining ground because America's made it that way for him. Oh, and by the way, don't let me forget before the end of the show, which is almost over right now, USA Freedom passed. And Jason Ditz tells it straight at antiwar.com. That is the same thing as saying that the Patriot Act Section 215 has been renewed. It's not really different. That's in there. 215 now exists again. The fact that the court just said that the law doesn't say what they interpreted it to mean, that relevant means any and all records that could ever be relevant someday in a hypothetical situation, I don't guess that mattered too much. And Rand Paul, you know, it was a symbolic victory. And the USA Freedom Act is a slight improvement on the way it was, but it's very slight. And read Jason Ditz's very, you know, jaundiced eye view of that at antiwar.com right now, news.antiwar.com. He's got a great little write-up there on the USA Freedom Act. And then I barely mentioned this before the break yesterday, but I got to mention it again right now, is this they red-teamed again, and they very rarely do this because it never works out the way they'd like. The feds red-teamed the TSA, and they succeeded in sneaking in 95% of the weapons they were trying to smuggle into American airports. Hey, where was the music? God dang it, Bobby. I didn't hear no music. Did you guys hear?